Good morning. It's time for In the Green Outdoors with Gail Martin and Carol Kelly. Each week, the ladies will bring you gardening and planting ideas, tell you about native Ohio plants, prairies and habitats, and great tips for everything in the green outdoors. This week with Carol Kelly.
Hello again, everyone. Well, in my last segment 2 weeks ago, I expressed happiness at the rainfall we had received the week prior to my show. But within a few days, the rain was becoming rather too much of a good thing. The grass was getting shaggy, but the frequent showers off and on, day and night, was keeping it too sodden to mow. So I went out to harvest the snap beans morning and night. They were growing so fast, thanks to the rain and the warm daytime temperatures. But the weather pattern has changed once more, and aside from a very brief light shower last Wednesday evening, we were again in need of a good soaking rain. In the meantime, while any native plants with their naturally deep roots should be fine with periods of low precipitation, be sure to keep your vegetable garden watered regularly. The rainfall we'd had earlier in the month meant that plant roots didn't have to grow down too deeply to find moisture, so now such plants may be even more dependent upon you, the gardener, for the water that they require. If you had tomatoes ripening during those rainy spells, you may have noticed that they tended to crack as a result of taking on too much water. Picking them while not yet fully ripe helps to avoid cracking in most varieties, and the fruit will ripen just fine indoors. They need not be on a sunny windowsill either, but will be fine on your kitchen counter. If your summer or winter squash is still hanging in there, I hope you are checking them daily and removing and crushing any of the shiny brown squash bug eggs that you will locate under or atop the leaves. But even the diligent gardener cannot always find all the eggs, and on a couple of mornings I've gone out to find closely packed herds of tiny black and gray newly hatched nymphs clustered on young squash. They move quicker than I can crush them all, so instead I reach for my recycled scouring powder can filled with diatomaceous earth, and I dust the critters on the fruit and surrounding leaves. The powder, called DE for short, kills insects mechanically rather than through chemical poisoning. This fine powder is made of fossilized algae shells composed of silica, which features microscopic razor-sharp edges that abrade an insect's protective waxy outer layer and absorb body moisture, which causes fatal dehydration. With that in mind, remember that it does not differentiate between pests and predators or pollinators, so be careful where you scatter it. And be especially careful not to breathe in any of the dust, for it is harmful to human lungs. Of course, the dust also works on cucumber beetles. However, the beetles don't cluster together, so it's more difficult to cover enough of the foliage to really be effective. These beetles spread a bacterial wilt, and my cucumber plants succumbed to that by the first week in August. I have since started a couple of new plants, first under lights in the basement, and then I moved them to our screened back porch until they were large enough to pot on for a week or two before actually planting them in the raised bed. Once in the ground, I keep them covered with floating row cover now, in hopes that the beetles will have ceased to be a problem by the time the cucumber flowers appear, and I'll need to uncover the plants. I have enough pickles yet from a very successful harvest last year, so if I only get enough cucumbers for eating fresh, that's fine with me. I started late lettuce and broccoli in the same manner as the cucumbers. That is, I've started the seeds indoors, and now I've planted them into the empty spaces left when I dug the early potatoes and the spring peas. The late peas I direct seeded are vining now, and I'm looking forward to seeing the purple snap peas begin to bloom once they reach their full height on the tree branches that I set along the row for them to twine upon. Now, once more moving out of the garden and looking farther afield, over the last few weeks, vigorously growing roadside vegetation has become larger and bushier, perhaps rather more so than some other years thanks to those earlier rains, and in many areas we are seeing more color as late-season perennial natives are in full bloom. I do not need to look very closely to see that often the large, busy, bushy clumps that lack showy flowers are giant ragweed. I find myself thinking how happy I am that I was one of the lucky people who eventually outgrew my ragweed allergy some years ago. In a relatively uncommon switch, ragweeds, native to the Americas, have been introduced to Europe starting in the 19th century, and more so during World War I, and have spread there since the 1950s. Several of the introduced species have since naturalized there and have become invasive on the continent. Considering how many invasive species have come to the Americas from abroad, perhaps one might be forgiven for feeling little sympathy for this fact. Ragweed, though, is still rare in the UK, but researchers predict that by 2050, it could be scattering pollen throughout much of Britain and into Northern Europe. Both ragweed plants are covered with millions of tiny flowers that are pouring forth clouds of irritating pollen that may be detected hundreds of miles out at sea. While common ragweed, with its fern-like leaves, may grow up to 4 feet tall, giant ragweed may reach 15 feet. The height is determined by the density of the infestation. If it's not crowded, a single ragweed plant may produce up to 1 billion pollen grains. Researchers have found that under even moderate levels of global warming, too, in some areas in the not-too-distant future, pollen levels could increase by as much as 12 times the current amount. Both common and giant ragweed produce separate male and female flowers on the same plant. As you may recall, plants that have this arrangement are called monoecious. Conversely, dioecious plants bear male and female flowers on completely separate plants. On ragweed, the tiny flowers form in short-stalked clusters called racemes. The male flowers that produce pollen are on top, while the female flowers are hidden in clusters at the base of the cluster, along the stem, or in the leaf axils. This arrangement is similar to that of corn plants. Tassels are the male flowers, and their location atop the plant increases the chances of pollination. Because these types of plants depend upon the wind for pollination, although some bees do visit the tassels during the pollen shedding season in order to gather some protein-rich pollen. The greenish flowers of ragweeds, however, offer no nectar, so while bees may occasionally visit ragweed if other flowers are scarce, pollinators, as a rule, ignore both species of ragweed. And now at this point I feel compelled to repeat what I know I have said here before, that it is not goldenrod that's the culprit in the case of late summer allergies, but ragweed. The fact that the showy blooms of goldenrod appear in late summer and coincide with the definitely non-showy blooms of both common and giant ragweed have made poor goldenrod the scapegoat. As I mentioned last time, bordering roadsides and farmers' fields in Marion County are vigorous stands of horseweed, also called mare's tail, and this too is in bloom now. The height and foliage resembles goldenrod, but the plants have very inconspicuous, tiny, daisy-like white flowers and are not really visible unless you get up close. These little flowers, however, do attract native bees, flies, wasps, and butterflies, so weed although it is, horseweed is an important late-season food source for smaller and uncommon wild pollinators. A question I often get around this time of year is, why are some springtime shrubs re-blooming? Someone just mentioned to me the other day that a forsythia has put forth some flowers. I also have seen the occasional magnolia or rhododendron producing a few blooms around this time of year. The observant and curious among us may wonder why these plants seem to be marching to a different drummer. The official term for this startling behavior of plants that uncharacteristically bloom twice within a year is remontant. The term is most often applied to roses and refers to what we plain-spoken gardeners call reblooming plants. Obviously, these are plants that bloom in their expected spring season, but then suddenly produce an unexpected second set of flowers later in the year. In the landscaping world, remontant plants are extremely desirable, and this reblooming trait is intentionally selected for and sought out in order to create new hybrid plants. Reblooming irises are one example. These have been bred to produce bloom stalks more than once a year, first in spring as usual, but then again in late summer or fall. Although they have a tendency to rebloom, they are not guaranteed to do so a second time. Repeat bloom is dependent on many things, including geographic location and growing conditions. But it's definitely worth trying these new varieties for a chance at a second round of stunning blooms if you are an iris aficionado. According to White Flower Farm catalog, Immortality is a variety that they sell that rarely disappoints. Remember that plants like magnolias, rhododendrons, lilac, forsythia, and even crabapples set bloom for the next year during the current growing season. It's the formation of those blooms for next year that often contributes to remontant tendencies of certain plants. The blooms must be formed and ready to go by the time the plants shut down and go dormant for winter. So some plants, after a strong growth phase, followed by a period of stress, such as a very hot, dry summer, followed by a late summer rainy period and moderating temperatures, seem to trigger a limited set of flowers. Although we can admire that out-of-season bloom, bear in mind that if individual flowers do bloom now, they will not bloom again during the typical bloom time the following year. So a downside of remontant blooms is a slight reduction in overall flower numbers for next year's floral display, depending on the number of flowers that actually do bloom out of season. Rarely will remontant plants be totally without any flowers during their typical bloom time the following spring, though, so simply enjoy that out-of-season bloom as a bonus gift from Mother Nature. Well, it's been a busy week in the garden and is only likely to get busier. This is Carol Kelly saying, as usual, keep ahead of the weeds and enjoy the monarchs that we are starting to see more of, also painted ladies and a few other butterflies among our zinnias and black-eyed Susans here in the green outdoors.
And there's your show for the week. In the Green Outdoors is a production of WZMO Radio. The show airs Saturdays and Mondays right after the second cup at about 9:30 a.m. If you have a question or comment for Carol or Gail, you can email it. Thank you for listening.